Now, you're on Five Body by that time. I think it starts in 2005, the website. So are you finding the multi-body model useful to get past these crass, you know, lump and proletariat?
Okay. Labels.
The subtleties, like we talk about the street culture, and you know all the different shades, or my old line, you know the different kinds of snow, like the Eskimo. Using the four bodies does make you see more than the average perception. You're like the Eskimo, seeing four kinds of snow.
You know? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you're thinking about that stuff, also acting out quadrophrenic, but you know you're shifting all over the place. So when you get in California, what do you remember? I don't recall, unless you mention it, then I might remember. What was your bee in your bonnet in L.A.? I know you hated Orange County, but then you liked some other parts.
I liked Glendale a little bit. I liked Whittier when I left because I realized what I had. Let's see, other parts of Southern California that I liked? Well, there's this remote little place that wasn't really a place I could live, but Claremont, which is like 30 miles out. And then there's Pasadena, which is actually, you know, it's Caltech is a lot more, it's an underrated university. Like, they always say, oh, there's no intelligence in Southern California. Like, yeah, well, Caltech has, like, the top five alumni for, like, you know, PhD organizations and so on. And so, like, Caltech is where a lot of NASA was around, these jet propulsion laboratories. So there are some brains in Southern California. It's all not just sprawl and suntans.
Yeah, now I recall, I think you didn't like the bleak highway culture. I think
Right, I started to get away. At first, I used to hoik it up because I was like, I'm tired of these smart growth cities that are so expensive and densely populated and everyone's just so, I want a little space. And then I started to get too much in that sprawl. I was like, fuck, it takes like 3 hours just to get somewhere and fucking everybody talks about, do you have a car, do you have a car? I was like, no, I don't have a fucking car, so... Then I started to feel alienated with that. So, yeah, I started to drift away from that.
And then that moves you up to San Francisco and Berkeley, and then you get into the porn for a few days.
Yeah.
Right? That's moving out of L.A.
Yeah.
So we did that, and then what happens? You end up back down in Whittier again?
I don't really remember.
I'm just, like, we know you were in L.A. for Salt Lake City, but that's after you've been in San Francisco.
That's where I have the blacks. I have, like, a blackout around San Francisco.
Oh, yeah, you go up to Portland in that. It's Seattle.
Yeah, yeah, I always, like, have this blackout. That's where it happened, like, from San Francisco to Portland. I was like, oh, my whole life is, like, fuzzy.
Yeah, because you didn't have anything.
Right, right. And so I just took that money and I traveled to Wyoming, and then that didn't end up, so I went out to Portland, and then I was homeless, and then scrawling around Albany, Oregon, and Portland, Oregon. And
so when you're homeless, you're walking around, how's your day go? Try to give an average, I mean, this is the blackout period, this is your lowest point, or maybe your most interesting point, but it's extreme, and I know you're out in Portland, that area. How would your day go? You had nothing to eat. What would you
do? I'd get, like, a little piece of paper out, and I'd know where the churches have food, so you'd go eat at a certain time, like, at the noon. And Portland wasn't as good with that as, say, Seattle. So I kind of, like, I was actually kind of hungry in Portland as opposed to being homeless in Seattle because there was less of these places to go eat. And I didn't like walking far, so I was lazy. So I actually had food poisoning because I was eating food out of garbage at one point at a mall.
And what
really
happens
stupid.
When you get food poisoning? You're sick and you can't move and you're laying
someplace? You have, like, diarrhea for, like, a week and a half, and then you have to go to the hospital, which goes on my debt, because everything in the United States, you go to the hospital every time they treat you without insurance, basically it goes on your debt. So
where are you going to the bathroom before you get to the hospital if you've got diarrhea? Where do you
do it? Just out in public. You know, you just learn how to watch the stores and where people are not so uptight about loiterers. So you learn to go to this bookstore at this time or that Starbucks at that time. You just kind of run in and run out without, you know, the store employee complaining about you. It's just, you gotta be quick.
You go into the washroom.
Just wash my face, you know.
Yeah.
Take a paper towel, you know, wipe my armpits or whatever. And
you had to go to the hospital. You did.
Yeah.
And now that's around the time the Virginia Tech mass murder guy happened, right? April 2007?
Yeah.
You were in Portland, I think, around that time.
I think so. I don't know. Or maybe I might have been in Wyoming on my way to Portland.
Right, and then you're posting stuff saying, you know, I'm all for this guy, I'm that guy.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
oh, yeah, I still identify with some aspects of that. I mean, not the violent aspect, but the symbolic aspect.
Right. So even though it looks nutty on Five Body, you actually are quite detached in what, from what you're writing.
Yeah, which kind of confuses people.
Yeah.
But I just not worry about it. But I did start to worry
acting.
About it later.
You were?
Yeah, yeah. I was just.
What'd you say about later?
Oh, well, finally I wrote something on the internet and there were repercussions for it.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll do. But this earlier phase, you're acting, right?
Yeah.
You're trying to be extreme.
Yeah, it's punk rock attitude. Just here I am. You know, here it is. I'm everything. I'm nothing. You know, it's just a statement, you know.
Right. So you were doing that, and I was aware of that, but it did, people would, maybe they were acting too, and pretending they were pissed off at you. Who knows, you know. It's theater there in cyberspace. So, now, what was that sentence you said? You got in trouble, you actually said something, and something happened?
I think it was in 2007. I was writing something on Five Bodied, I think, and I was basically hinting at how depressed I was, and I basically made a comment, yeah, on the mountain everything will happen, and I made like a YouTube clip of the Virgin Mary crying.
Oh yeah, you were threatening suicide occasionally.
Right, right, and
yeah.
It was the Virgin Mary crying, but it was like a passage from the Quran, so it's in Arabic. So they come to my hotel room, and when they tell me, like,
who's
yeah,
they? Who's they?
Oh, well, someone in Virginia, that's all I ever found out, made a call about my well-being. And
I remember
so,
you posting that. I was just going to say Virginia, but you weren't in Virginia. You're over in the Northwest.
Correct, Washington State. And
yeah.
So then, you know, so you got any weapons on you? Or, like, it says, we don't know. Like, what the fuck? Like, they made it look like I was going to go homicidal, suicidal, when all it was suicidal, and everything that I wrote had no innuendo of violence or anything. I guess just because it's freaking Islamic, like the Virgin Mary crying and like, oh, freak out, the Virgin Mary is like going to strap a bomb to her chest on the mountain. Like, who lives on the mountain? You know, like, I'm going to go to the mountain and kill myself is what I was insinuating, but they thought I was going to kill someone on Mount Rainier. Like, who
and
the fuck lives
they?
On Mount Rainier?
Right, who's they?
The cops. And when you,
not the Muslims. Are you still a member of the Islamic Church at this point?
Not really. I'm pretty agnostic. You know,
you convert and then you leave it. You know, off to
yeah,
California.
Just not showing up.
Yeah, that's your last gasp at the on the East Coast.
But yeah, that's my last grasp of any Islamic great attachment was actually in Washington State with that suicide, because I don't know, I was identifying with the Virgin Mary. I saw her as some pure or whatever, and it's just symbolic of some things that were happening with an older woman, and I felt like guilt and shame or whatever, and I just felt like I wanted to re-attenuate myself with something beyond that perversion that I discovered in Portland. So,
well, what happened when the cops came? Did they believe you?
Yeah, they believed me, but they still took me to this mental facility, and I had to stay there overnight. And if I didn't talk my way out of it, I'm pretty sure they would have kept me there. So I just pretty much, and it's really sad because you think, okay, someone who's killed himself, you're going to help them, right? You're going to counsel them. You're going to maybe prescribe them something from the state. No, no such thing exists. Not even a liberal state. That doesn't exist. And so what they do is they keep you in a room, and it feels like a prison, and you can't even see out the windows, really. And it's just like, oh, my God, this is so horrible. I should never have went and had this little emotional outburst of depression because being here is miserable. So I just said to him, yeah, whatever you say, I'm not going to hurt myself. I am feeling so much better right now. You're right. I'm going to be better. And so they let me out the next morning. But
and
that
where
was,
is that? What town is that?
The call was made to Fife, Washington, which is north of Tacoma, but the place it took me was a facility in Tacoma.
Right. How did you get around in your homeless period? You couldn't hitchhike, right?
Right. I would only hitchhike like down the city. I wouldn't hitchhike to another city. I never really hitchhiked.
How did you get around?
Oh, just make a little money and get a Greyhound ticket.
Oh, okay.
Gay porn,
so
taking
then,
money.
Right, so then after that, you end up back down in L.A. leading into joining the Salt Lake City Church?
Right. When I'm in just about to leave Whittier for Glendale. That's when I get into, like, the Mormon idea, because I was looking, you know, at this analysis. I said, okay, there are four countries that have a perfect score with, like, this United Nations Religious Freedom Survey or whatever, and United States was one of them, and the other three were Ireland, Estonia, and Hungary, and I noticed that United States has, like, 19 times the population of those other three. So I was saying, if there's any religion on Earth that's going to be anywhere, it's going to be United States, because, you know, it's pretty much true, because Europe is pretty secular, and they don't really care about inventing new religions, and, you know, Mormon religion was a mythic religion. It was made up, and it started out as this kind of tetradic, you know, kind of community. But I was interested because I was into transhumanism, and there was this organization called the World Transhumanist Association, which is the largest in the world. They're called Humanity Plus now, but the first religious organization to be recognized by them was actually a group of Mormon transhumanists. And the reason why is because in Mormon Christianity, they have a different idea of cosmology, which is actually, at least on this basic cosmological principle, is actually more scientific. They do not believe in creatio ex nihilo, which means that the universe was created out of nothing. Now, I know a lot of Catholics believe that. I know that's the New Age thing now to talk about this zero-point, resonant zero entity of the non-physical. But when you're talking about quantum mechanics and you're, like, disagreeing with, say, the Big Bang and the whole Stephen Hawking's black hole theory of gravity, it kind of makes more sense. So, I mean, the Mormons were not divorced from the material world. In fact, if you see them today, like, look pretty materialistic. So they're, I mean, if you've ever known, Salt Lake City was the fourth city to be on the Internet. Did you know that?
No.
The first city was Los Angeles out of the UCLA campus. The second was the Stanford Research Institute, which is not in Stanford, but it's actually in San Mateo County, I think.
No, wait.
At Menlo Park.
In the Dave Worster interview, we talk about on around September 5th, 69, they make the first hookup, forget the term, and then they go up to Stanford. Then I think they go to Salt Lake City. Is that what you mean? That first hooking up of different computers?
Yeah, there's four.
Yeah.
And it's L.A., Menlo Park, then Santa Barbara, then Salt Lake.
Right, and then maybe MIT or something comes in after that.
Well, MIT, they developed it. They actually brought the infrastructure that was to be transported to the West Coast to be implemented, but I think MIT would be, like, number five or six,
right.
But
right.
Salt Lake was technically online before MIT.
That's right. No, I'm now, this is a good book that goes through that history and talks about that weekend, how they, I can't remember the term for what they would wheel in, you know, in UCLA, and this is the time of the apex of polarity with Dave Worster and Cosmic Awareness up in Seattle. That is when the Internet, or whatever you call these computers talking to each other, that's when it began. And they started interlocking the universities in Salt Lake.
Utah is definitely a part of the military-industrial complex, and actually Silicon Valley started on the military-industrial complex. That's where they got their first grants for the land tracts, and actually the Stanford Research Institute was implicated in the Vietnam War for developing defense systems. So that's why they were boycotted. People don't know that, but...
Right. Now, don't the Mormons believe, maybe it's more esoteric doctrine, in UFOs or some kind of stuff like that? Did you hear any of that?
They believe in planets. They don't admit it today, but they do believe in a physical reality. They like to talk about it as transcendental in the old fundamental sense, but if you look at their older stuff, I've talked with some older members in the church, and there is an idea of actually populating a planet with godchildren, which people thought was some made-up shit, but actually it's still in vogue. I mean, a lot of it's been toned down. The actual statement against polygamy started in, like, I don't know, 1890 and then was fully eradicated around 1906. And they're very anti-polygamy right now, at least the corporate official church.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they are into that whole celestial expanse. And they
and
definitely
that,
have.
And you had to find that in the library. They would not teach you that one the first couple of weeks.
They would not teach me that, but I did find the person, a part of the official Mormon church who's been raised one, and he's basically a higher up, meaning he's like a high priest. And it starts out, they have a little hierarchy. Like, you start out, like, the young ones start in the Aaronic priesthood, and they go from deacon, teacher, to priest, and then they enter the Melchizedek priesthood around 18. and become an elder, and after becoming an elder, they become like a high priest. And so when you start to get in the temple, that's when the more hidden aspects of the church come in. I've only been inside one temple, and that was only because of an opening, which is open to the public. I'm still not temple ready, so to speak, which comes later after you're an elder. So they do have rites there that I've come to know that do exist, and so I believe the veracity of people who are inside it. So yeah, they do have some more esoteric things that compared to modern mainstream Christianity, definitely.
I'm just changing my battery, so I got you on a speaker. So let's move into you. The Mormon conversion happens after October 29th, 2008.
My Mormon conversion?
Yeah.
It happens, like, officially in March 2009. Officially, like legal, like on paper.
Well, let's go into the tragedy of your life, October 29th, and how that happened. What's that about?
Well, you see, most of my relationships are online. And so, you know, I chat with people online. And granted, that's, I guess you could say, pathetic or whatever, but that's kind of part of, like, some of our youth culture or whatever, and it's, I never really found myself attached to in a local area, so I just talk outward. So I found this girl that I was chatting with that I really liked, and basically I'm not afraid to admit that, yeah, she was my girlfriend. And, you know...
But did you ever meet her?
No.
But she.
But I
girlfriend.
Felt it was real, because, I mean, I know it's like a cliche, it happens over and over in, like, a young person's internet experience, and it's not as, say, real as something else you experience, but just from talking to her, I felt something unique from all the other various dozens and dozens of times, and I felt like a real connection. Like, she was very like a hand fitting a glove, like the perfect harmony almost with her, you know, like anything, how she would talk. And I was actually planning to move to Iowa just after her birthday, and I was trying to find a job, and she was already working, and she said she was going to move out of her parents and get an apartment.
And where was she living?
In a little town in Iowa.
And you, where were you at the time?
I was in Whittier. I was in Whittier,
right.
California.
And so you don't even talk to her on the phone. You're just typing to each other.
Right.
And do you write long stuff?
Yeah.
She spent a lot of time typing to you, and you spent a lot of time typing back, and that's a chip body romance.
Oh, yeah. It was. That's what it is.
And because she could, you liked the way what she wrote.
Yeah, like, I mean, she was just so gentle. She was very beautiful, slim, submissive, gentle, caring, aware, intelligent, understanding. I don't know, like, when you see many people, yeah, you can have some kind of thrill, like some random cybersex or whatever, and talk these obsessive poems to each other. But when you've seen so much, like I have, like the age of 25, like being on the internet for like about 6 years or whatever, you start to notice the difference. There was something unique about her, definitely, that was standing about above all else. That was kind of like, and it only felt more so when I found out she died, when I looked up her name in the obituary, and there she was in the local newspaper, which only, you know, like, yeah, she really died. She really existed, and she really died.
And you didn't know she died. But how did you find out?
It took me like about 2 weeks later or something. About her friend told me.
Oh, okay. But back to, and she's 18. How old is she?
Oh, she was actually 17, which is semi illegal, however you want to say it. But she was going to turn 18 one day before she died.
It's illegal to do what?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of like erotic, but I wouldn't say. I mean, like, that's pretty incriminating, but, you know,
It's illegal to type erotically to someone under 18.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Oh, okay. But did she respond erotically?
Yeah.
Okay, so we know the kids are younger in chemical body terms anyway, so, I mean, maybe it should be illegal at 13, but a 17-year-old, was she a virgin or you didn't know?
I can't remember that. I didn't really worry about that, but she had very virgin-like qualities.
Oh, okay. And she's in school?
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
And so she's spending a lot of time communicating to you, and she knows what you look like, and...
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Did she know your past, the kind of stuff we've talked about?
Oh, yeah, she knew everything about my past.
And yet,
I just let it out and said everything.
So she found that interesting or not a problem?
She just accepted it. She was just very, you know, calm person, and she would see, like, beyond that, you know. We would just click on a different level. I mean, later I found out that she was, like, not treated very well by people in her town. They would treat her pretty poorly.
Very small town?
Yeah, very small town, and they treated her very poorly, like her friends at school, and it's like...
Because she was too smart, too bookwormish, or what is it that would make
it stand out? I think they would just take advantage of just how meek she was, because she was so positive.
You said meek?
Yeah, well, she has, like, I would say she'd describe her as submissive. Like, she's just very, want to make sure people are happy, you know? And people would take that as a weakness.
Yeah. Okay, so you're in communicating to her for how long? 2 months?
About 3 months.
3 months, and then she's not there anymore.
Right.
And you're wondering, and then you get in touch with a friend somehow?
Yeah, and then they tell me that she died. A truck hit her. Her car was a little bit over the side of the intersection, and the truck was a little too much to the right, and it clipped her car, and it just killed her. And that's how it happened. It was raining, and all I know about the truck was that there was a Japanese flag on it.
Right, so you hear about this, and this is a devastating to you.
It's actually, people would find it hard to believe, but I'd count it as the most devastating psychological event in my whole entire life. And I've had things where I've been raped. I've had things where family members have died, friends have died, and, you know, I've had very other obsessive, relationships that lasted a lot longer than, like, 8 months or, you know, put a lot of time into it. And, you know, I had relationships in person as well. But just something about this particular event was the most traumatizing of all, because I associated with my independence. I associated about, you know, in the spring I was going to go move over to Iowa and that we were going to share an apartment together.
And that was agreed upon. She wanted you to come.
Yeah, she wanted me to come. She wanted me to come, and we were going to move in together, like, around spring, because I didn't want to go there in winter, because it was very cold. And I felt a lot of shame for that, because I felt I should have been there earlier.
Right.
But she died one day before her 18th birthday, so I'm like, and I feel like it was my fault, too, because she would stay up late talking to me on the internet, and I felt like maybe that what made her tired the next day when she was driving and didn't park her car behind the line.
Yeah.
And she could have probably avoided this very fast truck that's not even paying attention. And so I just felt a lot of bitter hatred. I mean, I literally cursed out at God, literally. The depth of my being, like, just imagine Lucifer or Satan. I'm just having rage towards God.
Is your mother witnessing this?
Some of it.
Yeah, you're with her.
Yeah.
And you're in Glendale or Whittier?
I was in Whittier, but when I found out, I was in Glendale.
Right, so... How long does this go on, this despair?
For months.
Really?
Several months. And even when I'm in the Mormon church, it was really so much just for aesthetics and social connections and exterior reality. It was never internalized enough. I was secretly hating God, you know.
While joining the church.
Right.
But yeah, you're joining the church for practical reasons, trying to get something that you can get a job or something. So you're faking it, and so what? I wanted to say this a little while ago. All the last four.
Well, there is a unique aspect of their priesthood which few or probably no other Christian denomination has.
What's that?
They actually have a priesthood that they prophecy will take part in the resurrection. Meaning, as opposed to the rest of Christianity, where God's supposed to resurrect us, or Jesus himself, it's actually taken apart as of with those, the believers, who are in the priesthood, meaning, you know, mortal men taking a part in the resurrection. So that kind of impressed upon me, like, I wanted to resurrect the dead. That's been my theme since that she died, that's my obsession.
Right. Now, what I wanted to say a while ago, that all this stuff we're recording about your life from 2004, 2005 up to last year, you're reading all the Pomo guys, aren't you? Derrida, Deleuze, and Guattari, all this?
I hated Derrida. I really hate Derrida. But yes, Deleuze and Guattari. And I'd read, like, British Pomo that is kind of more obscure, but they were into, like, Gothic materialism. And Croker would be, like, the main point, and they go to C theory and just browse through the articles. And
you got a lot of stuff. Like, you went into the Croker quadrant.
I like Zizek a bit, yeah. Like, he's a psychoanalyst that's pretty popular now, and I'd get into him.
See, so you're showing up at the Mormon church trying to get a job, and these people never heard of, you know, 80% of what you've read.
Correct.
They don't know that you've thought through the Croker quadrant and studied Croker as much as you could from the outside without meeting him. So all that, so what is, are you reading those guys during the months of despair?
Some of them. And then I've read just about anything, really.
Yeah, it's almost like, and you're on the internet.
Right. I mean, that's when I started to get into physics, though, because...
Yeah, see, what I'm seeing is that your chemical body was in despair. It was, and God is in the chemical body quadrant on my chart, so you're lashing out at God. But you're, meanwhile, have your, we'll call it your general media body, is reading books and all this stuff. You're on your chip body, typing and creating your MySpace and all that. You've got several bodies going on. Maybe what you're saying is that the chemical body, it was so devastating, it dragged you away from the other bodies. They stayed stuck in the chemical body, and it's a motion of despair. Is that...
Well, my laptop died around then, too.
Ah, so you didn't have that.
A computer, so you have a missing computer, and I'm dealing with that, and then...
And you were not able to post in five bodies in August, and then you have this tragedy in October.
Right.
So you were forced to hang around your chemical body for a while.
Yeah, and I actually stopped smoking the whole time I was in Glendale in Salt Lake.
Stopped smoking?
Altogether. That's been throughout my life. I start, I quit, but I just stopped when I was in Glendale and Salt Lake.
Do you know why?
I think just being around these Mormons and disciplinarian and just me just being fed up with the cheap thrill of cigarette smoke, because sometimes my body gets disgusted with things. I was on meth for 3 months straight, and then I stopped cold turkey. Like, I have a very addictive personality, but ironically, when I have, like, some kind of, like, emotional thing going on in my mind, I can literally just drop something, at least when it's connected to the chemical body. Like, I can eat plain food for months on end, or maybe not. So I just, just stop smoking.
If you have a good reason, your mind is that strong over your body.
It can be at times. It can. And people don't believe it, but they see it. My mother sees it.
Right. So I'm just sort of getting this pattern that you started to focus on, you knocked off five-bodied. Did you ever go and look at five-bodied even though you couldn't post?
A little bit.
Yeah, a little
bit. Like one or two posts every 3 days.
But it doesn't mean anything to you because you can't post, so you're not going to get too involved in what is being posted.
Right, and sometimes I didn't really like it. I thought it went a different path without me there.
right. So you're sort of focused more on your chemical body, and your laptop breaks before October 29th or after?
I cannot remember, but it breaks twice, and then it's finally dead, and I just throw it in the dumpster in Glendale, and I haven't had a computer since.
Okay, so your chemical body, you're focusing on not smoking, you're trying to be religious, with your chemical body in that context, and then you get smacked on the chemical body level by this death.
Right.
Interesting. Like you, LaRouche, you say, two special interests here. You specialize too much in the chemical body. You were actually going to go and move and have a relationship with a chemical body in Iowa.
Yeah, and physically, reality.
So I'm making up a new karma here. You have to live with your four bodies, moving towards the mystery landscape, and if you think you can drop off one of them, you'll pay for that. You know what I mean? Special interest. So we update LaRouche into body, two specialized body interests here. Now, this is ironic or a bit humorous, but it's interesting that you were trying to get focus in your chemical body, drop the others a little bit, and it led to a big car accident, you know, a big shock to your system.
Yeah.
So what's happened since then with that? Have you gotten out of that?
What, the depression?
Yeah.
We're
raving against God.
I was raving against God for a while, and then something, after I left Salt Lake, I was like, why not I become God?
After you left, after you left Salt Lake.
Right, when I went to Spokane, Washington.
Well, that would be developing your astral body.
Right.
Become God, you know, move, include the astral, get into it, dominate it.
But I mean from a left-hand perspective, meaning as a pagan perspective, like I am God, as opposed to not the Zen, Hindu, pantheistic sense, more like I have a following type.
I'll start your own cult or own
right,
group.
Left-hand path, yeah, left-hand path.
Who calls that left-hand Levant. Path?
I don't know, like the
Crowley?
The yeah, it's a very common term now, left-hand path. That's left-hand path goes to the right hemisphere, and remember, I'm going into a right-brain masculine identity as I leave Salt Lake.
And you're saying left-hand, which is starting your own church, is that what you're...
Yeah, pretty much.
That's left-hand path, mm-hmm. And that's not right hemisphere, or it is?
It is right hemisphere.
Okay, so now we can get into your categories. You have lesbian socialism. You have all these things, different things. Now, we establish that you're going to create your own cult, church, mm-hmm. And it's sort of like a chemical body, but it's inspired with astral body ideas.
Correct.
And are you going to use the computer to do it? Yes, you have your MySpace, right?
That's where the gist of the actually recruiting will be.
Right, and you watch TV or engage in any of the... TV landscape?
Occasionally.
You might read a newspaper or something?
Yeah.
Okay, so you leave... Okay, so now describe what's wrong with Obama, what's wrong with this, what's wrong with social... You know, you're telling me all these...
Well, I'm trying to get into a certain... If I were to classify my political reality, I would classify it a libertarian... conservative, socialist,
got to make one
radical.
You got to have four terms there.
Libertarian in the sense of I don't like schools. That's where the Cho persona comes from. I believe that professors are
you don't
paid
believe
too
in
much.
State education.
Correct. That's where my libertarian aspect comes from.
Okay.
My socialist end comes from is that I believe that in the long term, a society that finds equality in its income is going to survive longer than that with income inequality. And I think that's why the European Union is weathering this recession better than we are, in spite of the fact that, the financial entity came from over here, but London and Frankfurt were doing a lot of housing market bubble shit as well. And I think that's going to become apparent because you usually find these violent revolutions in times of great decadence, like the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution, the Tsar. So those things happen right after a time of great decadence, or even the Nazi Germany after the Weimar Republic. So I think, I believe in socialism because it even fits into my idea of polygyny, which is the specific form of polygamy with one male with many women, which is empower my dark, masculine, right-brain male persona.
Okay, hold it. So you believe in if we consider money as part of the chemical body, 19th century, do you believe that should be a guaranteed environment, a kind of welfare society,
yes.
Even though you don't have to go to school and go through state propaganda?
Right, which is hard, because usually the state socialist model is supported by the extension of the bureaucracy and the universities.
But this could work if we recognize a different medium. You can't get rid of money or
right.
That kind of afterimage of that medium from the industrial age. So that's given, but you don't need to believe in it.
Right.
And therefore you don't need state education. So that would work. Libertarian, you know, internet, you can educate yourself. You don't
on
have
video.
Yeah.
You're already doing it in India, like teaching kids algebra in, you know, elementary school over a computer screen.
And that would be for, that's the kind of education, left hemisphere education, whatever, to get a job within the leftover of the industrial meme. But people can get on the internet and learn all kinds of stuff, as you've been doing since you were 15 or 16, and that could be, that's the educational part, that's libertarian. You did
right.
Control that, so let's admit it. So, okay, that would be, libertarian would be the chip body, socialism would be the chemical body, so what were the other two?
Well, I'd be conservative, because I'd think, you know, that there are certain absolutes, and that's my value system. I don't really care about other people's value systems. I'm not a savior for the world. I'm the savior for myself. That's what I mean by the left-hand path isn't trying to fool anyone that I'm everyone's God. I'm just the God to some. So,
yeah, in other words, you'll find people of like mind who agree with whatever you're presenting.
Correct.
And that would be your community, maybe.
Yeah, or basically my following. I mean, that's why I felt like this right brain persona really was intensified in Whittier, because I find myself as a modern version of Charles Manson, but a more civilized, sane, certainly.
You got more bodies.
You're
talking about a Charles Manson on the chip body level.
But I'm a lot more sophisticated.
Right.
I would say.
Okay, so what was that called? Libertarian socialism and conservative. What are you conservative about?
I'm a sexist, and I'm not afraid to say it, but I'm a sexist who respects women.
That's the right hemisphere, male patriarch polygamist.
Right, as opposed to the left brain male, you know, patriarchal, who believes in prostitution. I'm against prostitution. I'm absolutely against that prostitution.
Okay, so...
And it's funny, because I was raised a prostitute, but I'm against it. I don't want anybody to be a prostitute. I think it's disgusting.
What did you say you were raised?
As a youth, as a young 20s, as a prostitute type person. I don't want to be a prostitute, and I don't want other people to be a prostitute.
Right. Okay, the conservative part of yourself is the chemical body part of yourself. You're talking about chemical body relationships.
Yeah.
While on your chip body, you're communicating, you got all kinds of people in the image, information, idea world aligning with you.
I include transhumanism in my little cult. I mean, what's the point of staying in a cult if there's no incentive to change? That's the bread or in the wine, so to speak, because otherwise people say, well, this is dogmatic totalitarianism,
right.
And well,
so
what's in it for me?
Yeah, what's transhumanism?
It's transforming the substrate of the human species to literally evolve. And that could be by any means, whether it be genetic engineering or by synthetic or cybernetic ways. So I take all the above, chemical body, cybernetic, everything. And but I usually look from the point of biochemistry, neurology, and physics.
See, okay, so that's not the conservative. That's not the chemical body. That's the fourth part. Would you call it radical anarchist?
It can be... radical. I wouldn't say anarchist. It's radical. It's only anarchist for my personal removing myself from society, but I don't believe in anarchy in itself.
Right. You're radical in that even though you're conservative in the chemical body, you allow the possibility it could be changed, the chemical body.
Yeah. Enhanced.
Yeah. What are those guys called? Extropians?
Yeah. Extropians/transhumanists.
Wow. Okay.
Who want to extend their lifespan. I mean, you're almost a transhumanist just by drinking diesel, almost.
I'm all those things and probably more. I'm basically happy and ready for more, whatever it is. You know, I don't hold back. I wouldn't categorize myself in any levels, but if somebody wants to talk categories, I'll attempt to understand them, what you mean. But I'm fitting you into my model, you know, my four-bodied model here. Probably being subject to... open to new possibilities of change in your physical or whatever levels, that is what I call the mystery landscape. That's what you don't know, and why would I exclude something that might come that I didn't know about?
Well, that's why I focus on resurrect. I think in the process of trying to find out how to resurrect the dead, you will probably land in the mystery landscape, because that's including the soul, and that's including things that we haven't observed yet, and that includes from, you know, so-called two different states of being, from death to life. And so I'd consider that approaching the mystery landscape, and that's why I've been studying these variant forms of physics.
Yeah, now when did you get this notion of... couldn't that be you want to resurrect your October 29th tragedy? You want to bring
her back? Absolutely. 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 And I want it in the fullest sense of the word, and no matter the idea of devastation, no matter what theologian tells me, even if it was impossible, I'm Faustian beyond Faustian, because I don't want anyone to tell me it's impossible. That's the mindset I have, very stubborn, obstinate, and I want to look in all aspects of it, because some people are just looking at, oh, well, we're just going to resurrect people and have them as a virtual computer chip about their memories. I'm like, no, I want qualitative, real, I want to actually experience the person, the real person, in the fullest sense, no matter what the devastation, like what if I don't have a piece of DNA? What if I cannot dig up the grave? What if the parents, you know, say, no, you cannot have this piece of DNA? You know, what am I going to do? I have to look at the soul. That's what I'm looking at. Soul and personality and giving it a body again. I'm from the perspective of what comes usually from religion or supernatural science fiction or just fantasies, but in the most powerful conception possible, which is why I have to study all directions of physics and really get really subatomic, because I have to find that minute reality and just bring it. And otherwise, I feel like a failure. And I think that's the only intellectual thing I'll ever tell anyone, because I really don't care about what people think about this dog-eat world. It's going to be dog-eat, and I don't care about this other shit. I just want to resurrect the dead. That's my desire. I'm already adamant about that.
And when did you get that notion?
2009.
Yeah, after you left the church, the Mormon church.
Yeah.
So it's part of you are going to create your own reality, lead your own church, and it's going to have fantastic options like resurrecting the dead. So would that have happened after your birthday in March?
Yeah.
Interesting, because...
Well, probably before. I was probably thinking about resurrecting the dead as soon as she died, really.
Right. But you didn't make it intellectually organized until you get out of your despair, probably.
Right. Correct.
Yeah.
It just gets more processed as the time goes on.
Yeah, because what's interesting is Ion comes through on March 18th, 2009, and Ion and I are on a project to resurrect the dead, but that I don't know how to define it. I don't think it's the way it is that one would think with those words traditionally. We have new images, new aspects of it, and it's interesting that you picked that up in your own way.
Well, ever heard of auto-ionization?
Ionization?
Auto-ionization.
No, ionization? There's ION.
Yeah. I-O-N-I-Z-A-T-I-O-N.
Right, ion. Auto. Now, what's auto? A-U-T-O?
Yeah, like as in self.
Okay, self-ionization. So what is the meaning of ionization in that?
Well, right? It's something I read just a couple of days ago. I was trying to get into my notes before we had this little interview here, but basically auto-ionization can create shifts in quantum states. And I'm trying to find something within the natural world that can translate that into a biological and intelligent reality. Like, there's these people that are saying that they're theorizing. I mean, this could be absolutely wrong, but, you know, I make a mistake and I'll uncover a new leaf next time. But saying that the neutrino is possibly actually composed photons, and that there are something possibly called biophotons, which actually communicate within our DNA, and that actually helps, you know, the intelligence of our, you know, sequence actually play out. So I think maybe there is some quantum reality that translates from the deepest part of, like, the fabric of physics to, like, our very DNA. And you can, like, there's scales of it, like, going from subatomic to proton scale, atom scale, molecular scale, all the way to neurology. You know, like, I want to literally find something that is seamless, and I think that's why we have to learn to integrate our different sciences. And that's why I don't, like, just focus on one. I think we have to bring all the disciplines together, the chemical sciences, the atomic sciences.
Oh, yeah, and then the four bodies, which I say they already are seamlessly converged, and that's why we're in the mystery landscape. Now, what's interesting is what you just described on the particulate level is what Ion is saying about the subatomic element, whatever you call it, particle known as Ion. It is the corpus callosum, so to speak, between the neutron, proton, and electron. And that's another reason why we call ion, ion. There's multiple levels in the meaning. But
oh, it's a tactile kind of place.
Definitely. There's never been a medium that I've encountered that understood tactility or McLuhan and all that stuff from the bodies than Ion. So Ion has shown up at the right time. Previous mediums wouldn't go into that. Well, there's a different reason. Not that they're earlier. Ion is the leading edge of the leading edge. And it's up on my stuff, and it's coming up with fantastic new scenarios like resurrecting the dead. And through the metaphor of the word ion. So
I think it's imperative that we actually, not just intellectually, but truly really empirically approach this.
Yeah. So I was thinking that we've done almost 2 hours. We should do a part two sometime in a week or so with your papers.
Okay.
You know, because then you can focus. I like to just end maybe with this. What did you detect? It was interesting what you said. You detect Obama is something new, and it's past the post-information Bush image. Go into a bit about that.
Well, as you would say, and as I noticed from other people, Bush was kind of like the non-communicative, you know, just making the observer or the audience just kind of like deal with themselves and realizing that we're all being over-communicated with anyway, so we need to just pause. But really, that kind of overstayed itself, and really people were just really becoming just non-informed on some level, and it kind of lost its use.
It affected Wall Street, where Wall Street couldn't communicate.
Right, and therefore, we don't know what was going on, and now we have extreme amount of debt, and we're going into, like, a deep recession.
Yeah, it's not debt. It's a refusal to trust in communication. The banks don't trust each other. Nobody knows how to measure the results of any connection.
Well, capitalism failed under those conditions. I mean, it's the same thing that happened in Germany and, you know, New York in 1929, and it's the same kind of stupidity.
Well, that was by radio. The new any software medium will cause a economic crash. TV did it, radio did it. Now we have the chip computer does it, and then it crashes. So we're in a very new, opportunistic time. And notions like resurrecting dead fit this. So go on about what do you see in the image of Obama?
Well, I'm really disappointed in the way that he manages, you know, our money, so to speak. But in one positive aspect, I would say, is that people are beginning to see themselves more active socially or politically because they see the desperation coming. And, you know, we're not really so worked up in this idea of,
receiving communications from the center.
Right, but we're learning how to be more sociable in the sense of we could create a community. Like, I feel like as a person who practices polygamy, I actually feel more safe under Obama than Bush simply for the fact that the competitive environment kind of brings people to this state of desperation. And as I was saying about the anthropological level of what they found, like the ratio of polygamy, one man with several females, there are four elements. It increases when there's competition between men and men and equality between woman and woman. And it decreases when there's competition between woman and woman and equality between men and men. But the most important element of the four is not competition between men and men. Meaning, we don't really need to be like these extraneous millionaires to live these extraneous lives. Really, it's more like what we're in relationship to. And this uniformity is what I'm trying to recreate in a masculine form of socialism. And Obama is certainly more of a masculine edge than Hillary. Hillary is more of the bureaucratic type old theater of, you know, which would exemplify the right brain male-female aspect, which is really kind of like a bourgeois reality that's continuing itself. And Obama was kind of like a masculine socialist reaction in a certain sense, even though there's some emasculated qualities about him. I mean, he was raised by, a white liberal female, and it looks pretty obvious to me that he has shame about his black father. I mean, even though if he leaves his son and goes back to Africa, I think, you know, he shouldn't have that kind of weakness, you know, and it seems like his wife's persona is kind of more active. But in spite of all these faults, I see him as definitely more ready to approach things that haven't been approached before. I think Bush really didn't give a fuck about the outside world. I think Obama's really ready to approach the outside world. So maybe Obama is ignoring the internal world almost as much as Bush, but at least his idea of talking to other people is like there might be more of an extra national presence, you know? It's more than just being an American now. It's almost like, you know, our persona is going to extend beyond, you know, this nation state idea.
Yeah, so as you see people reaching out, looking for community in some form or some level, not sure which body would be on, but probably using all bodies just in case, you know, don't hedge your bets. So you see Obama miming that. He's taking the centralized image of the White House and reaching out.
Yes.
Trying to see if there's any structure for it. Or any.
Right, and I find myself more able to deal in a kind of like an equal poverty than a false statistic of liberal capitalism saying, oh, we have made so much during this little stimulus package and, you know, all these little rich liberal cities are rich again. I'd rather see things equalized because, I don't know, I used to have a big fear about socialism and equality and these things, but, I mean, after living through the United States, I mean, it's terrifying enough. And really, if he failed, he's only going to create a reactionary element. So I'm kind of glad for his successes and his failures at the same time because we're going to have more of an ironic situation after him.
Okay.
I mean, increase more irony.
Right. Well, let's see how long he lasts, and then Biden comes in, and we'll see what Biden will hear.
Oh, I'm terrified of Biden.
Okay, well, that's your reactionary thing.
Yeah, I'm reactionary. Well, you know, I'm actually thinking of moving to Canada or Europe soon.
Canada or Europe?
Yeah, if things do not work out. And that's if things do not work out at the age of 28, I will go to either Canada or Europe. And I have the means to do so.
And what, you are 27? No, 26 now.
Mm-hmm.
So you got two more years here. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot will be determined by within 2 years in general, so you'll have a good way to measure what's happening. Right now, you probably can't measure what's going to happen.
Yeah, true. 27 is my deadline. That's the last time I could join the Air Force. Which is the last time they'll let you join the Air Force is when you're 27.
Right, you were born on the 27th, or was it 26?
26.
26.
But if I were to calculate a ratio between the day that you were born and the day that you met Connie...
Yeah.
On
I remember
the calendar,
you working. I remember you working that out.
Yeah, it would be October 27th.
Hmm. And then I just told you that October 29th... I told you the other day when you told me about your friend dying, that October 29th was our special day, Bob and Connie's special day.
Well, I'll probably look at the 27th as a kind of reconciliation for, 29?
No, that's it's the weekend of 1966, and it's the weekend they turn the clocks back, and I go for the number 29, but maybe Saturday was the 27th or 28th. You can look up an old calendar and check that out. Saturday, 1966, last Saturday of October.
I would say that 29 kind of resonates with the matriarchal kind of meme, though. So I wouldn't want to get too involved in that. I mean, you do have other anniversaries to worship. I mean, who cares about first? I mean, sometimes seconds are better than first. Sometimes marriage is better than dates. Sometimes that great moment is better than the other great moment. I mean, so maybe symbolically to you it is, but maybe you'll learn to understand my bitterness about number 29, and you'll learn to go over some other date, September something.
Well, then you got February 2nd, you got March 20th, you got September 5th, you got July 5th.
I've had several girlfriends who had the birthday March 20th.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And I think I still have one that does have that date. I am polygamous, by the way.
Yeah, it's a good day. No, it's the cusp of it's the last
of the Pisces.
Yeah, the last of the astrological calendar, and you're starting a new world, and it's also spring. It's a good date to have. So, on that devastating note, let's very good. Enjoy talking to you, and we'll do part two sometime in the next week or less or whatever. So, what do you have to do to get your papers? Are they in the computer somewhere?
Yeah, I probably have to write them down because I don't really get a lot of access to the computer during the weekend or whatever.
Right, so they're in the computer, but you can't print them out?
I think I can print them out.
Okay, so anyways, you do have papers, and that might be maybe going to the subatomics or whatever it is
yeah,
that the papers provide.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks, Kiggy. This is really good. I think those that know of you will be surprised at what they hear.
Okay.
But then again, this is your, you could say, electric body. It's your TV, radio, analog media body. It's a telephone. It's a lot different.
I'm waiting to obsolete gravity. That's what the whole new cosmological model is trying to get rid of, is the gravity-centered universe, which is more electrical, plasma-oriented. So I hate gravity, and I hate those who orient themselves to it.
Well, that's another ion project, and, you know, gravity is countered by radio and television. That's why Einstein had to counter Newton or come up with something. So we are floating in the analog discarnate state. The digital state's a bit different, but it includes the floating. So far we've got resurrecting the dead and gravity. Those probably were issues that Joyce was discussing in Finnegan's Wake. So let's resonate.
We can end it. Okay.
End with that one. Thanks a lot, and we'll talk soon. So,
okay.
Just a minute. Let me just think if there's a postscript. So when we discussed the other day, and you're the anti-Bob, and I didn't know you're the anti-Connie, and you said, oh, no, I'm not anti-Connie.
I'm not, because it has to deal with the situation irony. See, when you're approaching the hexatic level, and these, like, very popular memes that are going around, say, are apocalyptic memes, say, for example, 666 and 888, 6 is, on the local level, hexatically apparent, but it ends pentatically. And 8, on the local scale, is pentatic, but it ends hexatically. And I'm saying, as anti-Bob, is on your chart, resonates with green. And as I was saying, in daylight hours, the most variable hue of any color to the human eye is green. So what shade are we talking about? I'm anti-Bob, therefore anti-green, slash magenta, the Connie. But that makes me more of the hexatic, because it starts at 8, ends as the 888, as opposed to starting at 6 and ending at 6. And if I were to be anti-Connie, it would be like trying to surmise that, yeah, I am against this reality when the truth is not even a part of the equation, because it just doesn't fit into the symmetry. So it's like there's no point in being anti-Connie, because there's the point about being anti-Bob is to create this friction, this synthesis. And at the same time, I'm not really the anti-Bob. I'm more like the anti-Bob, the ambivalent Bob, and the other Bob.
No, very good. I did predict on CKLN that after lockdown Bob rule, the final war would between, or an ongoing war would between Bob and the church, and that's what you've just expressed. Very good. So it's been a pleasure having you a member of my church, or more power to your church, and that's it.
Okay.
Okay, Scott.